Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, June 25, 2026. Thousands feared dead in Venezuela after two major earthquakes, by Vivian Sequeira and Mayela Armas. Caracas. Thousands of Venezuelans were feared dead on Thursday after two powerful earthquakes wreaked havoc in and around the capital, Caracas, trapping people beneath the rubble of collapsed buildings and setting off powerful aftershocks. A magnitude 7.2 earthquake hit about 160 kilometers, 100 miles west of Caracas on Wednesday afternoon, followed less than a minute later by a magnitude 7.5 tremor, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Emergency workers scrambled over the debris of collapsed buildings in Caracas as night fell, while distraught relatives sought help for loved ones feared trapped. Dazed survivors were taken away, some on stretchers. "When we went downstairs, the scene was like a horror movie," said Maria Alejandra, a resident from a nearby building who did not give her surname. "We had to climb over the rubble and everything, the building superintendent with the baby and all the neighbors coming down, but from that building, I only saw that one family got out." Interim President Delcy Rodriguez said at least 164 people were confirmed dead and nearly 1,000 injured, and the government was working with business to deploy heavy machinery to accelerate efforts to help those still trapped. The worst affected area was La Guaira State, near Caracas and home to the city's airport. Witnesses' footage showed scenes of panic as ceilings came down in the airport and rubble from destroyed buildings along the seafront. "Dozens of buildings have collapsed, and we are currently carrying out very intense rescue efforts to save as many lives as God allows us to save," Rodriguez said on state television just before 1 a.m. local time on Thursday. La Guaira State is a true tragedy and has become a disaster zone. Houses collapsed near the quake's epicenter in Morón, a small seaside town in the state of Carabobo, where there was no water or electricity. Three children were among at least eight killed in the area, Municipal Mayor Emily Riera told Reuters. The U.S. Geological Survey, using predictive modeling to estimate the death toll, said it would most likely run into the thousands, with a substantial probability of exceeding 10,000. A website set up to track missing people and posted on X by leaders from the country's opposition, many of whom are outside Venezuela, listed more than 10,000 people as unaccounted for at 5:40 a.m. local time. Pardon me. Many Venezuelans were at home when the quake struck during a public holiday. "There was a very loud crash. Things fell in the house, jugs inside the refrigerator. I've never experienced anything like it," said Coro Martinez, 56, who lives in eastern Caracas. Rodriguez said rescue crews from other countries would arrive soon and thanked leaders including U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. She called for unity in Venezuela, where anti-government protests over annual inflation of more than 500% have become more frequent since Trump ordered the capture of President Nicolas Maduro in a violent raid in January. Trump said there had been a devastating number of deaths. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said search and rescue teams were being deployed and the Pentagon would deploy assets to the damaged airport. Other cities and towns close to Caracas affected by the quake, including El Junquito and La Guaira, remained without power on Thursday morning, increasing challenges for rescue workers. The UN's Venezuela Human Rights Mission urged the government to lift restrictions on social media, saying it was a matter of life and death. Access became available in some areas of the country where cell services are unreliable. Residents across Caracas, where infrastructure was already crumbling due to lack of investment, rushed to evacuate as buildings shook. "As soon as it started, we began hearing people screaming," said Astrid Ramirez, a 41-year-old publicist in western Caracas. "Everyone was running down the stairs." Maria Romero, an 80-year-old pensioner in southern Caracas, said police helped her out of her home. This earthquake was horrible, even worse than the one in 1967, she said, referring to a magnitude 6.3 quake that the USGS said killed 240 people. Venezuela lies in a seismically active zone where the Caribbean plate meets the South American plate. An estimated 30,000 people were killed when a quake caused widespread destruction in Mérida and Caracas in 1812, according to the USGS. At Caracas Hospital de Clínicas, staff doubled up on the night shift to help treat the injured, a worker there said. School classes were canceled for the rest of the week. The city's stock exchange was closed and will be used to help rescue efforts. The Venezuelan Red Cross said its headquarters had been critically damaged, but sent rescue teams to the worst affected areas. France said its embassy was badly damaged. Near the epicenter, workers were restarting the Morón petrochemical complex, Venezuela's second largest in operation, a local firefighter chief said, after they were told not to come in while damage was assessed. Other oil infrastructure appeared to be unaffected. Chevron, the main foreign partner of Venezuela's state-run oil company PDVSA, said all employees were accounted for and operations were continuing. UK oil firm Shell, which is evaluating developing gas fields in Venezuela, said all its employees were unhurt. Ditch your routine, warning, as Europe's deadly heat wave takes its toll. By Dominique Vidalon and Sam Tabariti. Paris, London. Authorities in France and Britain warned people to ditch their routines on Thursday, as large parts of Western Europe remained in the grip of a deadly heat wave that has claimed dozens of lives, disrupted power supplies, and shut schools and cultural landmarks. French Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu activated the highest level of health services mobilization in the face of the heat wave, meaning non-urgent operations could be canceled to focus on caring for those affected by the hot weather. Paris endured another sweltering day after temperatures in the French capital hit a June record of 40.9 degrees Celsius, 105.6 degrees Fahrenheit on Wednesday. Parts of southern England and Wales faced another day of record-breaking temperatures after a new June high of 36.1 Celsius was provisionally set in the southern English county of Hampshire on Wednesday. Britain's Met Office extended a red heat alert covering a large area into Friday, the first time such warnings have been issued for 3 days in a row. Significant disruption to daily life is likely, and the public should take every effort to adapt their daily routines to cope with these levels of heat, which up to now have been extremely rare for the UK, said Andy Page, a chief meteorologist at the Met Office. France implemented a number of measures against heat waves after one in 2003 caused nearly 15,000 excess deaths, with the elderly the hardest hit. This time around, active younger people were a big concern, said Emmanuel Grégoire, the mayor of Paris. Rather, it's people aged between 50 and 70 who are generally in good health, but who think this is just a normal period and continue going about their usual activities as if nothing has changed. Really, protect yourselves, he told broadcaster TF1. At least 48 people have died in France from drowning since the start of the heat wave while trying to cool off, authorities said. And three young children are known to have been killed by heat in cars in two separate incidents. Since the end of last week, more than 20 people across Germany have lost their lives in swimming-related accidents, the German Life Saving Association said in a statement to Reuters. In Italy, media reported that 5 people had died on Wednesday from heat-related incidents. The heat wave, expected to peak over the next 3 days, could endanger the health of up to 1.5 million Italian workers, including builders, farmers, and couriers, according to estimates by the Italian CGIL Trade Union and Greenpeace Italy. Several regions have banned outdoor work during the hottest times of the day, and the government this week said firms forced to pause work due to the heat could access funds for furloughed staff. Changes introduced in France since the 2003 heat wave included checking in on the elderly regularly and offering those in a retirement home the chance to spend several hours a day in a room with air conditioning. Air conditioning remains relatively rare in Europe, but Asian makers of air conditioners, such as South Korea's Samsung Electronics, China's Midea, and Japan's Mitsubishi Electric, are enjoying a boom in sales, with strong demand from countries such as France, Spain, and Italy. The heat wave is being driven by a weather pattern known as an Omega block, pushing temperatures as much as 18 Celsius above normal, according to the Reuters Climate Monitor. The phenomenon resembles the shape of the Greek letter Omega, with a bulbous middle trapping in heat over regions for extended periods, with cooler weather on its fringes. Heat waves and storms are being intensified by climate change. French Education Minister Edouard Giffray said that 13,500 schools were closed or placed on special schedules on Thursday. More than 1,000 schools closed or were partially closed in Britain as the temperature in some classrooms climbed to over 40 Celsius, and authorities worry about extreme heat on treeless playgrounds, with the end of term still a few weeks away for many. U.S. tourist Keegan Cronin, playing with her children in sprinklers in Paris, said that was a nice spot, but it was just too hot. "The children are very uncomfortable. We are actually going to leave a little early because it's too hot. We're going to leave Paris early," she said. Germany's National Meteorological Service issued extreme heat warnings for a large area of western Germany, with temperatures expected to rise to 38 Celsius on Thursday and 41 Celsius on Friday and Saturday. A half marathon run scheduled for Sunday in the northern city of Hamburg was postponed. In neighboring Austria, the National Weather Service issued a red heat warning for the northeast of the country, including Vienna, this weekend, when the temperature in the capital could hit a record 40 Celsius. Formula One's governing body declared a heat hazard for the Austrian Grand Prix at Spielberg's Red Bull Ring in the south of the country this weekend. That requires teams to fit a driver cooling system, such as a liquid-cooled vest, though drivers are not obliged to use them and can take a ballast penalty instead. Oil back to pre-war levels as Hormuz traffic rebounds. U.S. tries to reassure Gulf allies. By Tala Ramadan, David Morgan, and Patricia Zengerly. Dubai, Washington. Oil prices fell to pre-war levels on Thursday, as the United States said flows through the Strait of Hormuz were nearing normal, and its top diplomat wrapped up a Gulf tour aimed at winning support for a preliminary Iran deal. U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright said shipments through the strait were approaching levels seen before the U.S. and Israel launched strikes on Iran on February 28, with at least 20 million barrels exiting the strait in the previous 24 hours. During the conflict, Iran took effective control of the vital choke point, disrupting oil flows and rattling global energy markets and the wider economy. Despite the recovery in traffic, Iran signaled it would continue to assert control. Its Revolutionary Guards on Thursday warned vessels to stick to routes through the strait designated by Tehran, rejecting newly announced shipping routes not coordinated with Iran as unacceptable and dangerous. The warning came after Oman announced temporary shipping lanes through the strait in coordination with the United Nations Shipping Agency. Data from the UN's International Maritime Organization showed that 57 ships carrying about 1,100 seafarers have transited the strait since June 23 under the evacuation plan. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio sought to reassure Gulf allies wary of Washington's preliminary accord with Tehran. After meeting with Gulf Arab foreign ministers in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, he told reporters that Gulf allies shared some serious concerns and that they wanted to be informed of every step of the peace accord, which includes provisions on the Strait of Hormuz. If Iran threatens or blocks ships in the strait, then we're going to have a problem, Rubio said, having earlier told ministers, no country on earth has the right to charge for the use of international waterways, and that fees for shipping would never be part of any deal. Badr bin Hamad al-Busald, the foreign minister of Oman, which lies across the strait from Iran, told the meeting that future shipping arrangements should not involve tolls. The diplomatic push comes as U.S. President Donald Trump faces growing criticism at home over the Iran war. In a closed-door meeting with fellow Republicans on Wednesday, Trump clashed with Senator Bill Cassidy shortly before his administration asked Congress for tens of billions of dollars to pay for the conflict. Several Republicans who attended said Trump engaged in a shouting match with Cassidy, who said the administration needed to explain the framework deal Trump signed last week that gives Iran financial incentives but falls short of the goals he laid out at the war's beginning. It does not appear, although I don't know for sure, that the course of this is going the way that we were told, Cassidy told reporters. In a move seen as supportive of Trump, Senate Republican leaders scheduled a late-night vote to block a resolution seeking to end hostilities with Iran. The Senate voted 50-47 to stop the War Powers Measure, which had advanced procedurally in May. This vote puts Iran on notice, Trump said on social media after Wednesday's vote, although it does not affect the earlier vote. The war is weighing heavily on Trump ahead of November elections that will determine control of Congress. Just one in four Americans believes the war was worth its costs, a Reuters Ipsos poll showed. Conflicting accounts have emerged over elements of the framework deal, which has prompted criticism of Trump at home and abroad. Iran's top negotiator Mohammad Bakir Kalibaf said on Thursday that the U.S. assertion that Iran would spend its unfrozen assets to buy U.S. agricultural products was false. Disagreements also persist over financial incentives for Iran, nuclear inspections, control of the Strait of Hormuz, and Israel's parallel war in Lebanon. The deal sets up 60 days of talks to tackle thornier issues such as Iran's nuclear program. The deal has provoked skepticism in the Middle East, where many states came under attack from Iran during the war and view it as too generous to Tehran, including a $300 billion fund and the easing of some sanctions. Washington's Gulf allies fear the reconstruction fund could help Iran rebuild its military. Rubio said he did not discuss the fund with Gulf ministers on Thursday. The accord also does not address Tehran's ballistic missile capacity. Under the agreement, Iran must allow shipping to move freely through the Strait of Hormuz for 60 days, and Tehran has suggested it might impose tolls after that. Washington and its Gulf allies oppose such fees. On Thursday, senior Israeli and Lebanese officials denied there had been any Israeli withdrawal from occupied southern Lebanon, after a U.S. official said Israel had pulled some of its troops back in a good-faith gesture. Israel has been battling Hezbollah in Lebanon since the militant group attacked Israel on March 2 in support of Iran, and Tehran has made a cessation of hostilities there central to its demands in any lasting peace deal with the United States. Truce brings no relief for displaced from Lebanon's destroyed, occupied towns. By Ali Hankir and Mohammed Azakir. Beirut. A long-awaited ceasefire has brought relative calm to Lebanon, but it hasn't brought peace of mind to Hussein Merhi. He is among tens of thousands who remain displaced because their homes were destroyed in Israeli strikes on their hometowns fall within a swath of the south occupied by Israel's military, or, as in his case, both. I still can't go back to my village. It's still occupied. My house is gone, and my livelihood is gone," said the one-time farmer, who was living in the historic Lebanese border town of Kafar Kila, which now lies destroyed. Mary, 39, spoke to Reuters in a university being used as a shelter in the southern Lebanese port city of Sidon, following a ceasefire that took hold on Saturday between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah. "We were displaced and we're going to remain displaced. There's a ceasefire. What did I gain?" Israel's military began an air and ground campaign in Lebanon in early March in retaliation for armed group Hezbollah's fire at Israel in support of Iran. As it expanded its operations, it ordered residents to leave large parts of southern Lebanon, as well as areas in the east and near the capital Beirut, some far from the front lines. More than 1.2 million people were displaced during the fighting, about a fifth of the population. Most of the displaced fled to relatives' homes in safer areas, but tens of thousands moved to government-run displacement shelters. The ceasefire that took hold on June 20 appeared to allow some to return to their villages. Out of more than 103,000 in displacement shelters before the ceasefire, about 14,000 had left by Wednesday, according to figures from Lebanese authorities. Local officials in some southern Lebanese towns told Reuters this week that families were returning, but numbers were hard to estimate, as many found their homes in ruins. Lebanon's National Council for Scientific Research says more than 90,000 housing units were damaged or destroyed across the country from the war's start on March 2 until June 12. Merhi's mother, 64-year-old Zara Chahadeh, told Reuters she hoped the government would provide housing as renting was too expensive for her family, who now had no income, without access to their farm in Kafar Kila. "Like everyone else, I felt like I wanted to go back to my village, go back to my home. There's no house, no village, nothing at all. What am I supposed to feel?" she said. Israeli troops remain deployed 10 kilometers, 6.2 miles into the south, a zone that includes dozens of Lebanese villages and which Israeli officials say remains off limits. Israel's Defense Minister Israel Katz said earlier in the war that troops would destroy all houses in villages near the border and that residents would not be allowed to return until northern Israel was safe. Amnesty International said earlier this month that Israel's use of the mass displacement and no-return orders was a violation of international humanitarian law. Israel's military says the orders are intended to protect civilians from harm. Lebanon and Israel are discussing a U.S.-backed proposal for Israeli forces to hand some Lebanese territory to Lebanon's military, but it remained unclear how much land Israel would withdraw from and how quickly. Authorities have been bracing for a long-term displacement crisis if Israeli troops remain in southern Lebanon. Lebanese officials said they were exploring the possibility of prefabricated housing or cash for rent programs, but finding funds and open land were challenges. In Beirut, the city council said on Wednesday it was giving people living in makeshift camps along streets time to gather their belongings in preparation for their final removal in the coming hours. That has left some with nowhere to go. Ala Kobesi, who hails from the southern town of Zebdin, said his extended family's homes had been too badly damaged for them to return home. He had fled to Iraq during the 2024 war between Israel and Hezbollah and was now displaced again. "The main problem is that I don't have a place," the 40-year-old told Reuters on the streets of Beirut, with the tarp of his disassembled tent in a pile next to him. Lebanon has suffered repeated rounds of conflict and economic crisis in recent decades that have prompted hundreds of thousands of people to emigrate. The latest war came as the country was still struggling to recover from the 2024 conflict. "We in Lebanon have gone from migration to displacement to migration to the ground," We've thrown everything to the ground, the Lebanese flag, the tents, and our belongings. Russia denies pressuring Belarus to widen Ukraine conflict. Minsk blames West. By Reuters. Moscow. Russia on Thursday denied exerting pressure on Belarus to support an expansion of the war in Ukraine, while Belarus said it was the West that was trying to drag it into the conflict. The former Soviet state is strategically important to all sides, being closely allied to Moscow and sharing borders with Russia, Ukraine, and three NATO states. With Moscow's forces struggling to advance and Ukraine raining drones on targets far inside Russia, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said repeatedly that he believes Moscow wants to get Belarus more involved on the Russian side. The Wall Street Journal reported on Wednesday that Russia wanted to use Belarus as a springboard to set up attacks on Ukraine, and that Moscow was threatening to cut financial support if it did not agree. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the report does not correspond to reality, and that Belarus was our closest ally. Belarusian Defense Minister Viktor Krenin said it was the West that was stoking tension. The situation along our borders is extremely unstable and escalating. Beyond our borders, NATO troop formations are being reinforced, infrastructure is being upgraded, the military budgets of neighboring states are expanding, and politicians are making strident militaristic statements, he said in a speech to graduating officers. Efforts are underway to prolong or even expand the hot conflict unleashed by the West in Ukraine. Today we are acutely aware of a blatant attempt to drag Belarus into the war. European states vehemently deny Russian allegations that they are responsible for the war in Ukraine, against which Russia launched a full-scale invasion in 2022. Last Friday, Zelensky said that signal relay stations in Belarus were being used to guide Russian drone attacks on Ukraine. He gave Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko a week to remove them, adding, "If he doesn't do it, we'll do it." On Wednesday, Zelensky said the stations had stopped working. Reuters could not independently verify his assessment. Peskov said he had no information on the issue. While Lukashenko has not sent Belarusian troops to fight alongside Russia, he let President Vladimir Putin use Belarus as a launch pad to invade Ukraine and later agreed to let Russia station tactical nuclear missiles on Belarusian territory. Belarus also conducts frequent joint military exercises with Russia and allows Moscow to use its bases and training grounds. While Moscow is the dominant partner, it also relies on Belarus, which has two large refineries, to process Russian oil and sell gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel back to Russia. That supply loop has become increasingly important this year, as Ukraine has intensified attacks on oil refineries in Russia, creating widespread fuel shortages. In the first 5 months of this year, rail shipments of gasoline from Belarusian refineries to Russia surged nearly 13-fold compared to the same period last year, while shipments of Belarusian diesel tripled, according to Reuters sources. Poland and Ukraine's difficult history creates political minefield for Tusk. By Marek Szczeslecki and Barbara Erling. Warsaw. As policymakers discuss Ukraine's reconstruction in Poland on Thursday, the government in Warsaw is struggling to diffuse tensions over history that could hamper collaboration as Kyiv eyes a path to peace and European Union membership. President Karol Nawrocki's decision to strip Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky of Poland's top honor due to a dispute over the naming of an army unit over insurgents who massacred Poles in World War II unleashed the biggest diplomatic crisis between the neighbors since Russia's 2022 invasion. Zelensky opted not to attend Thursday's Ukraine Reconstruction Conference in the Baltic port city of Gdansk, as he sought to insulate the gathering from the row. Navracki's move also marked a challenge to the pro-European coalition government of Prime Minister Donald Tusk, which will have to balance its more conciliatory approach to Kyiv with rising negativity about Ukraine among voters. It's plain to see that Navracki truly has it in his mind that he must make life difficult for the government at all costs, even at the expense of Poland's position, and he's certainly succeeding, said a source close to the government. Navracki has rejected any suggestion that domestic politics played a part in his decision to strip President Zelensky of the Order of the White Eagle, Poland's highest honor. While Poles remain strong supporters of Kyiv's war effort, public sentiment towards Ukraine has grown increasingly negative in recent years due to weariness with refugees, disputes over grain imports, and the legacy of the World War II killings. According to an SW Research poll for Rzeczpospolita Daily, 51.9% of Poles said Zelensky's decision to name an army unit after the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, UPA, had harmed their attitude towards Ukraine. Some Ukrainians regard the UPA as heroes for the resistance they mounted against the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, and as symbols of Kyiv's struggle for independence from Moscow. But the UPA was also involved in the Volyna massacres, a series of killings from 1943 to 1945, in which Poland says around 100,000 Poles were killed by Ukrainian nationalists. Thousands of Ukrainians also died in reprisal killings. Tusk and Zelensky met in Brussels just a day before Navracki decided to strip the Ukrainian president of the Order of the White Eagle. Two sources close to the Polish government said they had discussed how to de-escalate the situation. The next thing was the escalation by Navracki, and we have a massive problem, the source said. Navracki first raised the issue in May, and his allies say he gave Zelensky ample time to reverse his decision, accusing the Ukrainian president of deliberately offending Poland to distract from corruption scandals closer to home. The world is increasingly talking about how much money was stolen by Ukrainians associated with Zelensky's team, making it even more obvious that he's trying to divert attention, also by stirring up historical disputes and insulting Poles, Marcin Przydacz, Navracki's foreign policy advisor, said on Monday. For his part, Zelensky said Navracki was trying to score political points ahead of a 2027 parliamentary election in which his allies from the Nationalist Law and Justice, PIS, party hope to return to government. Despite the tensions, most Poles see Ukraine's security as vital to their own and believe that Poland should be involved in any negotiations aimed at bringing the conflict to an end. Every decent, common-sense person knows that the quarrel between Poland and Ukraine is the greatest gift for the Russian president, Tusk said on Wednesday. However, Tusk's absence from a meeting of the leaders of Britain, Germany, and France, known as the E3, with Zelensky in London this month, raised concerns in Poland that it was being sidelined as Western European powers try to steer Kyiv toward talks with Moscow in the near future. Tusk did join the E3 leaders in Berlin on Wednesday in an expanded E5 format that also included Italy's prime minister. Poland has had and will have no doubts the future of Europe, the Western world, and Ukraine in this dramatic moment will depend on how well we preserve European and transatlantic unity, he said at that gathering. Tusk added that countries on NATO's eastern flank must be represented in all key formats. Diplomats say escalation of the current dispute could make it more difficult for Warsaw to play a key role in negotiations. If Poland wants to be involved in discussions on Ukraine, including formats like the E3, it is no surprise they are not invited if this is how they behave, said a European diplomat. Government sources say the administration cannot risk taking part in a competition over who can seem tougher on Ukraine that radicalizes sentiments among Poles. The next step is violence on the streets, so you simply can't afford it, the source close to the government said. Danish police find no proof drones caused Copenhagen airport shutdown. By Søren Jeppesen and Louise Rasmussen. Copenhagen. Danish police said on Thursday they had found no evidence to prove that flying objects that shut down Copenhagen airport last year were drones. After a 9-month investigation into what was seen at that time as a possible attack. Copenhagen Airport suspended flights on September 22 when the objects were seen in its airspace. In the days that followed, the Danish Air Force's main fighter jet base and other airports were also suspended operations after similar incidents. We cannot confirm that there has been drone activity in and around the airport. At the same time, we cannot rule out the possibility that there has been drone activity, Chief Police Inspector Søren Thomassen told reporters. No suspects had been identified, and the investigation was closed, he added. The incidents last year were seen as being part of a growing pattern of suspected hybrid warfare, targeting critical infrastructure across the Nordic and Baltic region, raising alarm among NATO allies. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen at the time described the incidents as the most serious hybrid attacks on the country's critical infrastructure to date, but refrained from attributing responsibility directly. Russia, which has regularly denied Western accusations of mounting drone and online attacks in Europe, particularly since its invasion of Ukraine, said it had nothing to do with the incidents in Denmark at the time. Justice Minister Nikolai Wammen on Thursday said the government and the authorities had taken the situation very seriously due to ongoing cyber attacks against European airports, airspace restrictions in Poland, and an upcoming European Union summit in Copenhagen. It is part of the nature of hybrid warfare that the adversary does not reveal itself, and there may therefore be cases in the future where it is far from certain that we will be able to get answers to all of our questions, he added. In a separate report published last week, the Danish Armed Forces concluded that, based on soldiers' reported observations and technical information, drones had flown over Danish military installations a number of times during September 2025. The Armed Forces said last week that responsibility for investigating and prosecuting any criminal conduct lay with the police. Spain's lower house calls on PM Sanchez to resign in non-binding vote. By Reuters. Madrid. The fragmented lower house of the Spanish parliament on Thursday passed a non-binding resolution urging Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to resign due to a slew of corruption scandals hounding his center-left socialist party and inner circle. The motion was approved by 177 to 171 votes and one abstention in the 350-seat chamber. A separate article urged Sanchez to submit to a motion of confidence if he does not call a snap election. Justice Minister Felix Bolaños dismissed the vote as purely symbolic with zero political effect. Only Sanchez has the power to decide whether there is a motion of confidence. On Wednesday, Sanchez again told Parliament he planned to stay on as premier, denying widespread corruption. The opposition can submit a motion of no confidence, but it has so far abstained from doing so, as it lacks the required votes to pass it. Supporting the resolution were the main opposition People's Party, the far-right allies Vox, as well as the pro-Catalan Independence Party, Junts, which traditionally opposes the two unionist parties. Junts' support was instrumental in allowing Sanchez to win another term as premier in 2023, but Junts announced last October it would no longer back the government's legislation. The motion says the mounting number of investigations into corruption cases involving political figures appointed and directly supported by Sanchez, requires that he take responsibility by resigning. Swedish minister brings baby to EU meeting, a first for the bloc. By Kate Abnett. Luxembourg. EU government's ministers gathered for a long day's discussion of climate change policies on Thursday, were surprised by a fresh-faced participant at their negotiating table, a three-month-old baby. Swedish climate minister Romina Pourmokhtari brought her son Adam to the EU Council meeting in Luxembourg to highlight the benefits of parental leave policies which don't force women to choose between work and family responsibilities. I wanted to showcase being an example of not having to make that choice, which of course also requires having a partner that's not a dinosaur, someone who's quite modern and up for it to tag along, Pourmokhtari told Reuters. An EU Council official confirmed it was the first time, to the institution's knowledge, that a baby had joined a meeting of EU ministers. Pourmokhtari, 30, was the youngest government minister in Sweden's history when she took office in 2022. She has just returned from parental leave, while her husband is on leave until Sweden's election in September, and traveled with her to Luxembourg to care for Adam. Sweden has one of the world's most generous parental leave policies, funded by the country's system of high taxes, which has become a political flashpoint in the election campaign. Parents receive about 16 months of paid leave in total. Of this, 90 days are reserved for each parent individually and cannot be transferred to the other. If a parent does not take their allotted portion, those days are forfeited. These non-transferable periods, often called dad months, were introduced to encourage fathers to spend more time with their children. Pourmokhtari credits this policy and support from her team with making it much less controversial for her husband to care for Adam while she works. She said supportive policies were not just a question of spending taxes on longer leave periods, and urged governments to also consider more flexible rules on parents sharing leave and affordable child care. It's creating a lot of value that shouldn't be underestimated, value that might not always be economic, but in the end might also be economic in not having burnt out workers, she said, referring to the burden on many parents struggling to juggle work and family. Krzysztof Bolesta, Poland's deputy climate minister, said it had been no trouble having a baby in a political meeting. I think it's great, he told Reuters. It's not a handicap. It's just part of life. UK moves to criminalize gender and sexuality conversion therapies. By Reuters. London. Britain on Thursday set out plans to criminalize abusive and harmful therapies intended to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. Government publishes draft conversion practices bill for England and Wales banning so-called conversion therapies. Offenders carrying out such practices could face an unlimited fine and/or up to 5 years in prison. The bill would also criminalize encouraging or assisting conversion therapies carried out outside England and Wales. Britain pledged to ban conversion practices in 2021, with a further commitment in January 2023. Measures in the draft bill would also create civil protections similar to those for forced marriage and female genital mutilation to protect those at risk of abuse. The legislation includes exemptions for what was described as legitimate health care, allowing therapists and counselors to continue open conversations about sexuality and identity. The proposed bill will undergo pre-legislative scrutiny before being introduced to Parliament for further debate. U.S. judge blocks Trump's mail-in voting executive order. By Nate Raymond and David Shepherdson. Boston. A federal judge in Boston on Thursday blocked implementation of U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order aiming to tighten rules for mail-in voting, preventing it from taking effect ahead of November elections that will decide control of Congress. U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani sided with a coalition of Democratic-led states that argued that the Republican president is trying to unlawfully interfere with the state's administration of federal elections. The Constitution does not grant the president any specific powers over elections, Talwani wrote. The judge, who was appointed by Democratic President Barack Obama, concluded that Trump's order violated the U.S. Constitution and the Republican president had exceeded his authority in trying to overhaul procedures for elections, which, since the Republic's founding in 1789, have been run by states and local governments. She said the president lacked any authority to compile voter lists for each state, and that USPS lacked any statutory authorization to adopt any binding regulations on mail-in voting. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump signed the order on March 31, after a years-long campaign to undermine faith in U.S. elections, including the false claim that his 2020 election defeat was the result of widespread voter fraud. He has called for years for tighter rules on voting by mail. His order directed the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to compile and transmit to the states a list of confirmed U.S. citizens eligible to vote in each state, derived from citizenship and naturalization records and other federal databases. Talwani, in siding with a group of 23 states and the District of Columbia that had sued under Trump's order, said any list DHS compiled of citizens would necessarily be incomplete due to privacy restrictions governing the sharing of sensitive personal data collected by government agencies. Trump's order also required the U.S. Postal Service to only deliver ballots to voters on each state's approved mail-in ballot list. USPS recently moved to implement Trump's directive by issuing new proposed rules requiring states to provide the names and barcodes tied to their mail-in ballots. The order also directs the U.S. Department of Justice to prioritize the investigation and prosecution of state and local election officials who issue federal ballots to people deemed not eligible to vote. Trump administration officials and investigators have fanned out across the country, re-examining fraud cases that have previously been dismissed. Talwani ruled after a different jurist, Trump-appointed U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols in Washington, D.C., declined to issue a preliminary injunction in a related lawsuit brought by Democrats challenging Trump's order. Nichols found that the Democrats' request was premature, as Trump's order had yet to be implemented. They are appealing. Trump has made winning approval of a divisive package of national voting restrictions his top priority, and on Wednesday stunned lawmakers by abruptly canceling a signing ceremony where they hoped to showcase newly passed bipartisan legislation to address the high cost of housing. U.S. Postmaster General David Steiner told Congress Wednesday that under its proposal, USPS would not deliver ballots in states where officials refused to provide lists of voters who received mailed ballots, but said he would comply with any court order blocking restrictions. Reflecting pool now under surveillance as Trump blames vandals for green algae. By Andrew Goudsward. Washington. The U.S. security apparatus is keeping watch at the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool, whose blue color has been fouled by green algae after being newly renovated at President Donald Trump's request. National Guard troops patrol the area around the roughly 2,000-foot-long basin on Washington's National Mall in groups of threes and fours. Solar-powered light towers illuminate the area at night, and roughly a half-dozen mobile security stations outfitted with surveillance cameras ring the perimeter. The stepped-up security measures follow a $14.7 million refurbishment of the reflecting pool. Trump has blamed dark-of-night saboteurs for the issues with the project, but has presented no evidence to support his claims. Green algae has been a persistent problem in the pool. The security presence unnerved Mary Jane Willard, a tourist from Seattle, Washington. "It's very sad to come here and see all the fences, to see all the National Guard here, to see all the cameras," Willard said on Wednesday. "It just shouldn't be here." 3 weeks ago, the Trump administration declared victory in completing work to repaint the landmark pool, which stretches from the Lincoln Memorial nearly to the Washington Monument. The color was American flag blue for the 250th anniversary of U.S. independence on July 4. In the days since, the pool has been beset by problems including blooms of algae, a long-running scourge that has tinted the water a vibrant green, and chips of blue paint peeling off the bottom. Days before the National Mall will host U.S. 250th anniversary celebrations, the reflecting pool has become the latest symbol of Trump's Washington, a test of his attempts to bend reality in his favor and command law enforcement to his personal whims. Trump has shown a personal interest in the reflecting pool project, one of a series of ways he has sought to put his stamp on Washington's monumental core. Trump has alleged, without providing evidence, that vandals cut a 250-foot or perhaps 350-foot gash in the pool, causing the chipped paint, and poured chemicals into the water to generate algae growth. Trump, pressed on the lack of evidence to support the allegations, told reporters on Monday, "At the right time, you'll see it. You'll see it in court." The Department of the Interior said in a social media post on Tuesday that 6 people have been arrested for alleged vandalism at the reflecting pool, and 7 more were issued federal citations. The department said it is also investigating the gash that Trump spoke about, though no evidence has emerged to support those claims. Neither the Department of the Interior nor the U.S. Park Police has disclosed the names of those charged or the offenses they are facing. Neither agency responded to a request for comment on Wednesday. Local and federal court records show no cases in recent days involving vandalism at the reflecting pool. Those arrested may not show up in local Washington, D.C. court records unless the U.S. Attorney's Office decides to bring a case. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, a Trump ally, told Fox News in an interview broadcast on Sunday that those charged will face the criminal justice system. One of those arrested was former U.S. Olympian David Hearn. Video posted on social media by conservative journalist Emily Miller showed Hearn, who was cycling near the pool, being approached by National Guard troops and later handcuffed by police. Hearn, in an interview with the Washington Post, denied destroying or removing any property, but said he reached into the pool and grabbed a partially detached piece of the peeling pool liner. Treating ordinary conduct as criminal diverts attention from the real questions of how this project was managed. Norm Eisen, a lawyer representing Hearn who has been involved in a series of lawsuits against the Trump administration, said in a statement, "Using the criminal justice system to target innocent people as a form of distraction is textbook authoritarian behavior." Hearn is due to appear in local Washington, D.C. court on July 9. Despite the stepped-up surveillance, the atmosphere near the reflecting pool was mostly relaxed on Wednesday as tourists enjoyed a sun-soaked early summer morning in Washington. "I came down to check it out for myself, but I actually think I was expecting something a little different. It looks pretty good to me," said Joanna Walling, who was visiting from Merritt Island, Florida. "It doesn't look like anyone's out here vandalizing today." U.S. PCE inflation measure tops 4.0% in May. Consumer spending strong. By Reuters. U.S. inflation increased further in May, breaking above 4.0% for the first time in 3 years, as the Middle East conflict boosted energy prices and potentially drawing the Federal Reserve closer to raising interest rates this year. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index surged 4.1% in the 12 months through May, the largest increase and first reading above 4.0% since April 2023, the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis said on Thursday. PCE inflation rose by an unrevised 3.8% in April. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast PCE inflation advancing 4.1%. The PCE price index climbed 0.4% month-on-month in May, after increasing 0.4% in April. The U.S.-led war against Iran has pushed up oil prices, driving gasoline prices higher. Though oil and gasoline prices have retreated in recent weeks amid a fragile ceasefire, economists expected inflation to remain elevated for a while. President Donald Trump and his Iranian counterpart Masoud Pezeshkian last week signed a preliminary peace deal that would reopen oil and other shipping lanes that were frozen by the war. Consumers were, before the conflict, already struggling with higher prices stemming from Trump's sweeping import tariffs. The higher cost of living is a political liability for Trump and his Republican Party, seeking to retain control of Congress in the midterm elections in November, amid mounting frustration over his stewardship of the economy. Trump won the 2024 presidential election in part because of his promise to lower inflation. Excluding the volatile food and energy components, the PCE price index increased 3.4% year-on-year in May, after rising 3.3% in April. The so-called core PCE inflation advanced 0.3% on a monthly basis after gaining 0.3% in April. The U.S. Central Bank tracks the PCE inflation measures for its 2% target. The Fed last week kept its benchmark overnight interest rate in the 3.50 to 3.75% range, but updated quarterly projections showed policymakers expected to raise borrowing costs this year amid growing concerns about inflation. Financial markets are betting a rate hike could come as soon as September, with another increase likely afterwards. Both headline and core PCE inflation were last below 2% in early 2021. Gross domestic product estimates for the second quarter are currently as high as a 3.0% annualized rate. But with inflation outpacing wage gains, the tax filing season behind, and savings dwindling, economists expect households will dial back spending in the third quarter. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.